get things rolling, because we don't want to go late. Because if we go late, I interfere with my own class.
No, I don't want to do that.
All right, so just to warn you all, not quite sure what the weather's going to bring. So it's very possible you might have to do the video thing again. But of course, hopefully the college, if they're going to do that, hopefully they'll be as proactive as they was this time around. It was nice knowing for me on Wednesday at around like 10 o'clock that they were going to cancel so I could make adjustments. But we will be fluid. We will roll the punches. Jameer. And CL1. I suppose I should do this as well. Elise. Nathan. Jane. James. And Tyler. And Manuel. All right. So, if you watch the video, you know where I left off. That's pretty much where I'm going to pick up. I will be probably grading the exams tomorrow. So as soon as I'm done, they'll send a notice, you know, that the conditions changed. You'll be able to go in. You'll be able to see what you did right, what you did wrong. The one thing that I'm pretty sure I'd let you guys know, but if I didn't, my bad, is I'm going to be scanning your essays for use of AI. So as it says in the syllabus, AI is not allowed in this class. So if I catch you, that's kind of cheating. And of course, there'll be penalties imposed. So that's one of the reasons why on the essays I don't deduct points from the spelling or grammatical mistakes. And I'd rather have you just kind of just type your thought the best you could. Yeah.
You're only supposed to pick one of the, like,
one of the sub questions. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I do that a la carte. You pick what you want, what you think you know best. Obviously, I want you to answer what you know best because you have a greater chance of getting points. If you answered all of them, you would have run out of time on the exam. You wouldn't have time to do it. But I'll deal with that once I start grading tomorrow. That's the other thing. I told you all, guys, about the early extra points if you do the early submission of the paper. Okay, I did that. I'm just trying to think. It's been like a whole week since I've been with you, so just going through the mental checklist, trying to think where we're at. I think that's good. Any questions about anything? All right, let's see if we can get through the Ming stuff and go on to the Qing. All right, so the Ming dynasty is regarded by Chinese history as a significant period because, to a degree, it was kind of like a period of rebirth. The Mongols came in. They had controlled China for 200 years. They did a lot of cultural and institutional damage. And then when the Ming came in, they basically tried fixing that damage to essentially reestablish the firmness of a true Chinese dynasty. And they did so by basically going in the past and bringing back the values that were important to the Chinese since time immemorial, in particular Confucianism. And Confucianism was, obviously it's a philosophy, but like Christian values on which our society is based upon, much of life in China was revolved around these Confucian ideals and Confucian values. So in order to bring this back, essentially China, as time was going forward, did take steps back, historically speaking, and went back to the past in order to move forward again. This is the reason why, like I said, it was huge. It was significant, truly revolutionary.
Why did they do that?
Well, the Chinese value historical perception. And again, like I talked about when I talked about Confucianism, the core of Confucianism is trying to make a stable society through harmony and balance. So if you have just gone through decades of warfare and violence and destruction, you know,
yeah.
I don't care who you are, you want peace.
Yeah, yeah.
So they had this idea on how to achieve it. It had worked previously, so they sought to do it again. Now, the impact of this caused a huge boom throughout society. Because once they stabilized their society, they also were in a different time than they were previously. We're talking the Ming Dynasty is established in the 15th century, around the time when the Portuguese penetrate the Asian trade network. And throughout the entirety of the Ming period, goods from as far away as the Americas began penetrating the Asian trade network and finding their way in. Now, traditionally, the Chinese had always tried to keep outsiders at bay. But during the Ming period, they started opening their doors a little bit. And that would also fuel the growth, fuel the boom. Trey, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. And Caden, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. So, one of the most tangible items that historians has analyzed is the importation of foodstuffs. Now, China, throughout its history, had always basically lived and died, like most, on food production. Whenever there was a drought or a famine or a natural disaster, food supplies diminished, which resulted in famine and death. China's population growth had always been stymied, therefore, on how much food they could grow. Again, nothing different than anywhere else in the world, but China, because the empire was so large, you're just talking more people. But during the Ming period, corn, sweet potatoes, peanuts, crops native to the New World, was brought in, and the Chinese discovered it could actually grow successfully in their soils. In particular, in the regions that did not have much water. So, China had been dependent upon rice production or millet production, but you needed lots of water, lots of stability in the climates in order for those to grow. But sweet potato, you can grow potatoes here. I mean, how many potatoes do we get from Maine, where it's cold, where it's rocky, where it's dry? So China basically could make food in places where food had never been able to grow. And that, of course, allowed for more babies. During the Ming period, China would also see an unprecedented population growth as a result. Now, of course, we don't have accurate numbers. But it's estimated that when Hong Wu first seized power in the 1360s, the population of China was about 80 million. But by the end of the Ming period, in 1600-ish, it had doubled. They believe it had doubled, 150, 160 million people. All because more food. With more people meant more opportunity to engage in business. And China, during the Ming, would also experience an unprecedented commercial boom. Every sector of domestic production grew. A lot of it is attributed to Hong Wu's reforms that I had talked about. He encouraged more people to take land that had not been farmed and to farm. He encouraged people, if you had a skill, produce goods, sell them, make a profit. Well, if you're able to mobilize a population that's growing in an economy that's growing, it only makes sense that production's going to increase. But China also had something that few civilizations in history had: access to the trade network. So goods that were produced in surplus that could not be consumed at home were put on ships and shipped to India, to Africa, to the Middle East. which means now there's more customers and a profit incentive to produce more. And I kid you not, you literally could find Chinese handicraft items, silks, textiles, tea, ceramics, as far away as Southwest Africa. Southeast Africa. Terms initially ran in Chinese favor because the Chinese items are considered luxury items. But of course, as we know, in order to trade, you want to maintain what's known as a favorable trade balance, meaning you are exporting more than you are importing. Why?
Make money.
If you are selling more than you are buying, you have a profit margin. What happens if the balance flips to an unfavorable trade balance?
Deficit,
debt. You end up spending more money than you take in. Well, China was aware of this. And China also was able to take advantage of the newcomers, the Europeans, who wanted these things and were willing to sail halfway around the world to get them and pay any price. And that's the key. Going back to what I talked about with the Portuguese learned that the Asians wanted nothing that the Europeans could produce other than silver. Which, of course, the Europeans were getting a lot of from the New World. So guess how the Chinese would maintain FTB? We're not going to barter for any of your stuff, but we'll let you buy it. You completely eliminate the imports, and all you're getting is cash. It is estimated that China received more American silver than any other single society in the world economy up until the middle of the 20th century. But how do you maintain the system? Chinese came up with a brilliant system, which ensured the demand. Because again, supply and demand, right? You never want to have a situation where the supply outstrips the demand. So how do you make sure there's always a demand? Well, the Chinese would develop what became known as the Canton system. Believing that unrestricted trade would lead to chaos, the Ming decided we are going to completely regulate the flow of goods in and out of China. By law, they would limit access to China from only two ports. Macau in the north, and Canton in the south, hence the name Canton system. If Europeans wanted those goods, they, Chinese goods, had to sail to whichever port the Chinese allowed you to go in. So, the Portuguese were allowed to go to Macau. The Dutch, the English, were allowed to go to Canton. If the Dutch or the English showed up in Macau, they would not be allowed to land their ships. If you went to the right port, you would then only be able to buy with silver the goods that the Chinese had for sale. Guess what they did not have for sale? Ever. Iron. Livestock. Weapons. Technology. But guess what they did have for sale? Lots and lots of rice. Lots and lots of chopsticks. Lots and lots of bolts of silk. Things that Chinese could produce in quantities so large that they are virtually valueless in China. But the Europeans were able to want to pay any price. So, you control the flow of goods. And you ensure FTP. Now, I'm not trying to be political, but guess what the Chinese have been doing to us for the last 20-odd years? Exactly the same thing.
Yep.
Now, the last consequence of this economic transformation was also an appearance of a new class of people, which we would call merchants, that had never existed really in Chinese history before. Because prior to the Ming, if you wanted something, you either had to make it yourself, or chances are you're just going to kind of barter with, you know, the family next door. Or maybe someone down the street in the village. But because of this sudden shift of surplus goods in quantities unthinkable, getting the goods from where they were produced to Canton and Macau required people who only did that for a job, for a career. And ultimately, this new class would make megabucks. Because as the Portuguese focused on, being the middleman is always profitable. Because you don't have to produce it, and you don't have to distribute it. You just get it from A to B. So they transported, they traded goods made by others. Now, ironically, in the Chinese social hierarchy, merchants are on the lowest rung. You have the scholar gentry up on top, you have the peasant farmer, you have the artisans and the craftsmen. The merchants were down there with the prostitutes. The reason being is the Chinese believed they didn't produce anything. They made their money by taking what other people produced and upcharging it. But nonetheless, it was a necessary evil, and they started making lots of money. And soon, any open real estate was being bought up by these merchants. Because they knew once they owned land, then they could rise in social status. There's your little social history block. Any questions? Well, if you have more people that have more food and you're making more money, you can put it to use and you can conquer more land. And during the Ming, Hong Wu and his successors continued militaristic actions for the first 50 years of the Ming Dynasty, going from the territory conquered by Hong Wu to its height during the third emperor's reign, Yongle. Yongle means perpetual happiness. Yongle happens to be Hong Wu's fourth son. He was like his father. He was a war leader. He personally led five expeditions, five armies that marched and expanded the borders. And again, I did a pretty good job coloring in the extent of the Ming, going as far south as Vietnam and Cambodia. Well, at its height, Yongle had global ideas. He wanted to know what was beyond his borders and was it worth continuing to conquer. So during his reign, one of the most bizarre events in Chinese history took place. Because it only happened this once. Yongle decides to send a Chinese expedition, a fleet, around the world. He would dispatch one of his most trusted subordinates, Zheng He. They would build a massive fleet and they would set sail across the Asian trade network, believed to be seven times. He went to Persia, he went to southern Arabia, he went to Africa, he sailed out into Indonesia. He sailed everywhere along the extent of the Asian trade network. And by the way, we know this because everywhere he went, they put into the ground massive stone stelae that was written in Chinese and translated into whatever the native language was in the area. And it was a list of goods that the Ming were willing to sell to anybody. Now, here's the most bizarre thing. It is possible that 100 years before the Portuguese did it, that he and his fleet, which, by the way, was bigger than any fleet that the Europeans could produce at the time. I should have put a picture, an estimate of the diagram of how big their boats were. You could, the boats that they built, you could compare them to modern seagoing vessels. They were like five times larger than anything the Europeans could build. And their fleet contained hundreds of ships. Well, it's believed possible that he circumnavigated Africa. Possibly crossing the Atlantic. And possibly going around the southern tip and coming all the way back. There are hints in the few sources that remain, but they've not found any physical evidence other than one weird thing. About 15 years ago, a group of marine archaeologists pulled out of the water around Argentina, off the coast, an anchor, an ancient anchor, bigger than anything that had been found, but it was a Chinese-style anchor. So it's possible that before the white men did it, the Chinese went around the earth and came back again. Now, unfortunately, when Yongle died, his son, who succeeded him, didn't see the value in this. So he ordered the fleet to be destroyed, and many of the records of the expeditions were also destroyed. So it is one of those things, what could have happened? How could the world have been different? All right, well, why did this occur? Well, unfortunately, times were a-changing. That is for sure. Ultimately, the Ultimately, the Ming fell victim to the dynastic circle. As it had happened, you're able to expand and look outward when times are good. But the moment you stopped expanding and you stagnate, what is eventually going to happen? You're eventually going to be overwhelmed and you're going to force to come back. And again, what they did was nothing different than what had happened over and over and over and over again. the good emperors gave rise to the emperors who gave rise to the bad emperors. Mediocre men, incompetent, unfit to call themselves rulers when compared to their predecessors. They were more focused on living the lifestyle than doing the job. You also had corruption, the same thing that ultimately would bring down the Yuan dynasty of the Mongols, just like it did the Song and the Han and the Zhou and every other dynasties, because the emperors weren't ruling. They were allowing people to rule in their emperor's name. They weren't paying attention. So going down to the local level, the government officials were taking money out of the tax coffers and living lifestyles larger than they were entitled to. And like we are seeing now in our country, which is kind of weird, this corruption entrenched in the United States is partly responsible for our $38 trillion worth of debt. And look at the kind of things that our government has been spending on that's being exposed. Again, I'm not saying orange man good, orange man bad, but when you start hearing about these multi-million dollar programs and where the money's going, when we have the people like down in North Carolina who were only getting $700 checks from the government when their houses were wiped out, or Florida or California, it makes you kind of wonder. Do a head scratch. Well, with the Ming, money was disappearing. And the only course that the government had was to start raising taxes. And why did they do this? Well, the infrastructure began collapsing. They didn't have money to fix the bridges, to fix the roads, to fix the canals. So when you don't have money for it, you raise taxes. By the way, our governor is proposing that. Our government has spent tens and actually billions of dollars on the migrants that have been deposited in Massachusetts. They used up all the money, now they have to raise taxes because our bridges are crumbling. And on top of that, as always happens, you have natural disasters. And if you can't have a stable infrastructure, the natural disasters are going to be extrapolated. Droughts, floods, famines. And of course, who suffers? The people. People always suffer. Stories at the last few decades of the Ming talk about peasants being forced to eat bark off of trees. Or geese poop. You know those big little nuggets that they leave around? Parents were forced to sell their children into slavery. Or to kill them to prevent the children from starving. There are stories of cannibalism. There also was uprising. Peasants would attack their landlords, attack the houses, kill the landlords, kill their family, burn things, crime, loot, devastation. Well, when you have village after village suddenly ignite, eventually, it's going to sweep across the land. Nothing new. You look throughout China, and this happens over and over again. That's the reason why they have the dynastic circle. And also, as has happened, when the wall can't be defended, that's when the bad guys start attacking. Nomadic peoples from beyond the wall, people that the Chinese refer to as barbarians, began penetrating into China and raid, attack, pillage, sack. But this time, things were a little different. The Mongolian hordes weren't coming in. But there was a new threat, but a foreign threat nonetheless. Now, one of the earliest examples of how far the Ming fell came with the appearance and assault of what the Chinese referred to as the Wukou. These were mostly Japanese pirates who had bases in the Sea of Japan. They took advantage of the fact that China destroyed its fleet. So they basically had control of the seas. And this was nothing new. Going back, the earliest stories of Wukou date back to the 4th century. But during the Ming, they were the most aggressive. They began attacking every single village and port along the coastline, from Vietnam all the way to Korea. And there was nothing the Chinese could do. The most aggressive height of these attacks came during the reign of Jiang Jin, who was the 12th out of the 15 Ming emperors. So I'm almost at the end. From 1522 to 1566, the records show the Wukou attacked 601 times. And the Chinese had no defense. So, one of the emperor's advisors decided to come up with a brilliant strategy. Because we don't know where they're coming from, because we can't do anything about it, what we are going to do is take all of the people who live along the coast and forcibly move them into the interior. And then we're just going to burn everything along the coast. Well, the problem is China has countless number of rivers. So guess what the Wukou began doing when there was nothing along the coast to attack? Yeah, they began sailing up the rivers and pillaging the villages on the inside. And what could the Ming do about it?
Nothing.
Nothing. As bad as that was, though, they also would have to deal with another group. The Christians. At around the same time the Ming is on the decline, appearing in the coastal regions, were Christian missionaries. Carried on Spanish and Portuguese ships. Mostly Franciscans, but there were also some Dominican monks as well. And they had orders from Rome to win converts among the commoners. Now they understood by this point the social structure of Chinese society, which I focused on India, but the same thing was there. You had the nobles and the emperors on top, and then you had the peasants. So originally, they decided maybe we could get some converts and do bottom up. But when the Franciscans and the Dominicans had little success, in came the Jesuits. And the Jesuits decided, yeah, we're not going to waste our time with the millions of commoners. No, no, no. We're going to go right to the top of society and do a top-down conversion. But the emperor, who was at the top, by law, foreigners were never allowed to come in contact with. So the Jesuits, not to be deterred, started focusing on some of the provincial leaders and the chief advisors. Well, here's the funny thing. And I'm not going to disparage my own faith. But Chinese thought is twice as old as Christianity. The Chinese, when they looked at the Gospels and Scripture and the religion as a whole, they thought it was silly. Why? Again, I am a Catholic. I am a faithful Catholic. And I don't say this to be offensive, but just ponder this. if you have never been exposed to Christianity, why would God allow his son to come down to earth and get killed? When you guys become dads, would you ever allow your son to get killed to prove a point? So the Chinese were like, again, you have this hierarchy. You have the five relationships of Confucianism. The upper and the lower. If anything, it would be the father that would go and make the sacrifice, because that's what dads do for their kids. It just made no sense. So the Jesuits realized, yeah, we're not going to be able to get this accomplished. Plus, let me be honest with you, look at the clothing, look at the pictures of the clothes that the Europeans used to wear in the 16th century compared to what the Chinese used to wear. Wool, dirty, smelly, hairy-faced barbarians. What do they know compared to the Chinese? Elegance, opulent, of silk robes, garnered with color, schematics, and images. I've been going off all day and I don't know who it is. So, the Chinese basically said, thank you, but no thank you. But I'll tell you one thing, you know what they were interested in? European technology. Because how do these hairy-faced, smelly barbarians get all the way around the world? And ironically, two guys willing to study the inner workings of the Chinese system and share with them European technology are Matteo Ricci and Adam Scholl. Both got to the capital. Both were allowed to stay within the Forbidden City. Neither met the emperor, but they managed to figure out the court process to actually have one-on-one meetings with ranking influential people in Chinese society. And these two helped the Chinese. They shared European wisdom. One of the biggest things they fixed was the Chinese calendar. The Chinese calendar was based on a calendar that had 350-something odd days. Plus, it didn't have leap year accounted for. So imagine if you're short on days, what's going to happen to your calendar 10, 50, 100 years down the line? Summer is going to be winter, and winter is going to be summer. So they helped share the Julian calendar. They also showed them European cast iron techniques, because that's how the Europeans made guns, big cannon, even though the Chinese invented gunpowder. They had nothing like this. They also brought in clocks, mechanical clocks, that were powered by springs that all you had to do was wind up. Well, the Chinese only had water clocks. Water clocks are great, but what happens if you put a little bit too much in? Or not enough? Your hours are going to be off. And most amazingly, the Europeans figured out how to predict eclipses. Well, in Chinese society, an eclipse is a sign of the Tian, the heaven, not being pleased. So angry that the sun or the moon ceases to exist for a period of time. That's kind of like the wake-up symbol, that the emperor has lost the mandate of heaven. Well, if the government can figure out when it's coming, think about the propaganda it can put out. No, that's not a sign of doom and gloom. That's a sign that the heavens pleased. But as far as converts, not so many. Questions? All right. Fast forward to 1644. 1644 is the year that the Ming, one of the most successful, revolutionary, powerful dynasties in Chinese history, came to a whimper of an end. in the end, came amazingly quick. Because it fell internally, toppled by rebels.
All right. You got it?
Okay.
I didn't want to bend over and clunk heads.
All right. What had happened? Well, very simple. By 1640, apparently, the Chinese peasants were no longer afraid of the Chinese army, because the Chinese army, not only had it not won a significant battle in over 100 years, but the soldiers themselves really weren't fighting because they weren't getting paid. So, the consequence of having no army resulted in a peasant rebellion literally spreading across China like wildfire. At the same time, a group of people called the Jurchen, but who the Chinese referred to as the Manchu, also managed to penetrate the wall and come into China. So, rebellion, invasion, the Ming were squished between a hammer and an anvil, and they ceased to be. Bless you. And as I already said, the armies deserted. But the sequence of events was not simultaneous. And it gives me a chance to tell another interesting story. Just as Hong Wu had done centuries before, the most successful prominent rebel leader, a man by the name of Li Qiang, would, with his rebel army, lay siege to the capital of Beijing, gain entry to the walls, because the army really didn't put up any resistance, and manage to penetrate the Forbidden City. That's the palace of the emperors. Well, the irony was the last Ming emperor, Chongqing, didn't even realize that there was a rebellion going on. He didn't understand, apparently, what was happening until he was walking through the hallways of the palace and he sees these weird people climbing over the walls. He quickly grabbed some of his officials and was asking, "What's happening?" Only to hear the story that the city has fallen. Well, he freaked out. Now, of course, the irony is Chongzheng, his throne name, means honorable and auspicious. I mention that because what he did was neither. Rather than face capture, he decided first, he's going to save his sons to preserve the dynasty. He orders them to dress like peasants and go hide into some of the other homes that are in the Forbidden City. And they're not to mention that they are his sons. Then he goes into the quarter where all his concubines were. He takes out his sword and he kills them all. Well, those are his women. He's not going to let anyone have his women. Then he decides he's going to go take care of the empress, but on his way he sees one of his daughters, takes a swing at her, cuts her arm off, believing that she would bleed out, but somehow she managed to survive. But he did kill one of his other daughters, cutting off her head. He then finds where the empress was and orders her to commit suicide, which she obeys, and she hangs herself instead of trying to run away. He then dresses like a eunuch, because no one's going to mess with a eunuch, because they're guys that have no balls.
Literally, that's the testicles cut off.
So he dresses like a eunuch, and he walks around humbly,
And he goes to the left, and he sees a whole bunch of barbarian rebels over there. And then he goes to the right, and he sees some more rebels over there. He tries to turn around, more rebels there. He realizes he's trapped.
Because what are they doing? They're killing all the eunuchs. So, he goes into one of the most inner courtyards, and he writes a note, puts it in his pocket, and hangs himself from a tree. Legend has it that the note was as follows. I die unable to face my ancestors in the underworld. I'm dejected and ashamed. May the rebels dismember my corpse and slaughter my officials, but let them not despoil the imperial tombs nor harm a single one of our people. Li Jiang seizes control, claims the mandate of heaven, and would establish one of the shortest dynasties in Chinese history, the Shun. Now that's not a click for a reason. Because the Shun lasted less than a year because they would be toppled by the Qing. Oh, one other thing. Li Qiang, got to give him some props. When they took down Zhong Xian's corpse, they actually buried him in the imperial tombs. And if you do go to Beijing, the Ming tombs still exist. Although they were looted by the communists. But the bodies are still in there. All right. The last Chinese dynasty. What I'm going to do is I am going to start the Qing. We're going to get to the 1800s, the 19th century, then we're going to stop. Then we're going to go to Japan, and we're going to do the same thing. Bring us up to the 19th century and stop. Then we're going to go to the Muslim kingdoms. We're going to stop at the 19th century because our third exam is going to cover the period of new imperialism. Because at this point, these peoples are still in control of their countries. But when we get to the 19th century, the Europeans would take over. So that's a topic for a different day. All right. Who were the Qing? The Qing actually were not Chinese. The last dynasty of China were actually foreigners. These are the Manchus. They managed to conquer China and establish dominion over it, and their dynasty would last a little more than 300 years. Now, who were the Manchu? They were very similar to the Mongolians. They were a bunch of nomadic people that were north of the wall, closer to Korea, though. But because of their proximity to China, they would soon, over time, assimilate Chinese customs. So they were Chinese-like. Their version of Genghis Khan was Chuang Chai. He was the Manchu king that would link all of the different tribes together into a single state. He and many of the Manchu nobles had actually adopted many of the Chinese ways. They had their own imperial exams. They had their own scholar gentry. They embraced Confucianism. They held Chinese court ceremonies. Because they saw themselves as cousins of the Chinese. So, because they were like Chinese, it should be no surprise, therefore, that in 1644, when the rebels were running amok, the officials of the Ming, unbeknownst to the emperor, actually reached out to Huang Chai and asked him for help. Why? Well, he had never proven himself to be hostile to the Ming. He had trade relations with the Ming. He encouraged his people to be fair and to the Ming. In fact, oftentimes he would wage war after asking the Ming if he could do so. In fact, at one point, the Manchus invaded much of Mongolia and beat the Mongolians down at the Ming request. So, because of their close proximity, the Ming basically asked them, look, can you come inside the wall and can you help us protect locations of vital importance? To which he said, fine. Because he came in not looking to be the emperor of China. Instead, he hoped to negotiate an agreement in which he would get the blessings of the Ming to push north into Siberia. He wanted the Ming to allow him to basically build his own northern kingdom. Well, he also asked the Ming for money. But while he was waiting for their response, the Ming opened the doors to the Great Wall and allowed the Manchu forces to come in. So he was actually inside China. Unfortunately, the Ming replied, no. We're not going to pay you for helping us. So he said, fine. You're not going to pay me and my soldiers? Well, we're going to come and get payment. So he organized his army and he marched towards Beijing. By the time he arrived, the Shun were in power. But he would lay siege to the city and eventually his army would take it. But he died before the siege ended. So, what does the Council of Manchu Nobles do? They would select Huang Chai's 5-year-old son to be the next Manchu king. They would rule as regents. And it was during this regency that the Manchu not only knocked out the Shun, but they also managed to beat down any Ming holdouts. And in less than 20 years, they managed to conquer all of China. They then presented themselves to the Chinese as being a Chinese dynasty. They proclaimed themselves the sons of heaven. They engaged in all of the required Confucian rituals. They publicly proclaimed support for all of the things of Confucianism that we've covered. The values of the relationships, the hierarchy, you know, old over young, male over female, emperor over subject. They also kept all of the government agencies that were there, including the imperial academies. So, for all sakes and purposes, it was similar to what took place back on January 20th. One presidential administration left and a new one comes in. And we still call him president. This is why your book refers to this period as the Ming-Qing period. Because other than the fact that you had a new family on the throne, nothing changed. They kept the exams. The scholar gentry that already had jobs, they were allowed to keep their jobs so long as they pledged loyalty to the new emperors. Ironically, even some who resisted Manchu rule but asked for forgiveness received pardons. They didn't do what the Yuan did. The Mongols went and killed them all. The emperors constantly talked about the importance of the family being the blueprint for social order. The male dominates the household, supported by the wife, the woman, and that the sons are the heirs apparent, and the daughters are there to help the mothers, but also learn how to become mothers themselves. It literally was the same. Nothing changed for the average person in the empire. And they did the same thing that the first three or four Ming emperors did. They not only conquered all that was there, but they expanded the borders. At its height, almost all of modern China, plus Korea, plus almost all of Southeast Asia. They took Taiwan. They also started conquering places in Indonesia. And they were effective. They also had a ruler that had one of the longest reigns in the history of the world. Kang Xi, the second Manchu emperor. He was on the throne for 61 years. He spearheaded this conquest. But it would be Kang Qi that would implement the one difference between the Qing and the Ming. Kang Qi would implement a policy which today we refer to as separate but equal. Anybody know what separate but equal means? This is the policy of Jim Crow. Does that ring a bell for anybody? No? During the United States, we had as the law of the land, separate but equal policies, segregation, where you had white schools and black schools. You had white water fountains and black water fountains. You had white bathrooms and black bathrooms. Now, the government could not deny a bathroom to anybody. So you had to have one of each, but there was no interracial connection. One for one group, another for the other group. So this was amazing when you consider the fact that all of the Chinese pretty much without a whimper accepted Manchu rule. It's also amazing when you consider that the Manchus only constituted 2% of the total population of the empire. But everything would be divided 50-50. So, for every minister, so say the minister of war, Kang Qi had a Chinese minister and a Manchu minister. For every unit in the army, you had a Manchu unit and you had a Chinese unit. There would be no commingling. Garrisons were segregated. Society was segregated. Manchus were forbidden to marry Chinese. Manchu children did not learn Chinese. Manchu children learned Manchu. Chinese children learned Chinese. And the last example I have in my notes, Manchu women were forbidden to foot bind, whereas the Chinese could. Question? All right. So were they good? Yeah. The first few Qing rulers would attempt to do what Hong Wu did. They saw all the problems that led to all the peasant revolts and they would try to fix it. So just like everything I covered during Hong Wu, they lowered the taxes. They lowered the labor requirements. They tried giving free land out. They worked on infrastructure, roads, canals, bridges.
Why can't I?
There we go. Everything that Hong Wu did, they tried. They tried new crops. They had tried incentives. But unfortunately, just like the Ming, they had little success dealing with the wealthy landowners. One of the reasons why is that during the end of the Ming period and all of the chaos, the wealthy basically gobbled up all the open space. So as a result, there was actually little land available. Plus, population boom. In order to handle a doubling of the population, you have to double the size of houses that are there. You have to double the size of the villages, the towns, the cities, which results in those farms being plowed over, just like we have going all around New England. They also didn't pass banking laws. I talked about that in the video, the usury laws. So the landlords could continue to charge 200% interest rates if they wanted to. So as a result, you had that rich-poor gap growing more significantly. Plus, the Qing also were never able to get a grip on the Canton system. During the Ming Dynasty, as we just said, the merchant class would control the trade. And as much as the state tried regulating it, it was the merchants that basically made all the rules. They were the ones who were moving goods. They were the ones setting the prices. And they were the ones getting rich. The biggest flaw was, how does the government profit over this? So if you have all these goods going out, and you have all this money coming in, how does the government actually profit? Well, you got to come up with a system so you can get taxes. So the one thing that the Ming did that is noteworthy is they essentially would revise the Canton system. Instead of allowing these foreign sailors to just willy-nilly sail into the ports, what Chengji decided to do is to create a business enterprise, similar to what the Europeans were doing. So this would be a licensed company called the Ocean Trading House, whose job as it was to basically control the ports of Macau and Canton. What they would do is radically different than what was done before. Before, the sailors could sail into the port and go right to the shore and offload whatever they had to offload and pick up whatever they were going to pick up. During the reign of Cheng Chi, there was an island in the middle of Canton, like there was a couple of islands in the middle of Macau. On these islands, they would build like a clearance center. We'll call it a factory, because that was the phrase that we used when we were talking about the Portuguese. So under the Qing, the ship would arrive, and instead of going to the shore, they would go to the island. Upon arrival, an officer of the Ocean Trading House would come on board. They would look at the manifest, the stuff that's in the cargo hold. They would reserve the right to inspect what was down there. And they would determine, upon arrival, what could the Europeans trade. Once they picked the items, they handed the ship captain a bill, which had to be paid. So there's the cha-ching. Once the ship captain paid the license, they then offloaded all of the stuff that they had on the island into buildings that were given to them, like their own little factories, and they would pick up whatever cargo had been collected. Before they left, another inspector would come on board. Let's look at the manifest. Look at what's going out. If they signed off on it, make sure there's no contraband on there, you're good to go. After you paid a second license fee. You paid to come in, you paid to come out. There's your government revenue stream. So as a result, the Europeans now essentially were paying the Chinese for the right to do business in China. So yes, the merchants were still profiting, but now the government was getting a taste. Questions? Well, once the Qing announced they were open for business, the Dutch, the Brits, later the French, then the Russians, and eventually the Americans, and the Germans, and the Italians. Soon every major European nation, the Japanese, began flocking to China to do business with the Chinese. And the amount of money that was flowing in allowed a certain limited class of merchants to become more powerful than even the Chinese nobles. These super wealthy merchants were called compradors. But to give you a good definition of this, they would become like the mafia. Because what happens if the Europeans wanted to buy stuff that the government wasn't going to allow you to get a hold of? Well, if you pay these guys enough money, they'll get whatever you want. And by the way, what happens if you have a product that you want to sell that the Chinese government doesn't want to allow you to sell? You pay them enough. It's amazing how that cargo could just disappear. So I only mention this as a juxtaposition. The government is trying to establish policies so it can regulate the system, and right from the get-go, it's being undermined. Questions? All right. Well, I got 5 minutes left, and I can just blast this out because I literally mentioned it about 20 minutes ago. The dynastic circle in China turned again. By the 18th century, mid to late 1700s, it was clear that the clocks were turning. Everything that I talked about before happened again. The exam system was corrupted. You had cheating. You had vice. People were getting jobs because they had money. They weren't trained. And then you had the compradors basically getting around all of the laws. As money started disappearing, they stopped being able to do the things that the government needed to do, such as build armies. So when we come back and talk about China for the third exam, we're going to see that the Europeans would send in expeditionary forces, a few thousand soldiers, and they would basically decimate armies of Chinese soldiers numbering in the tens of thousands. We're also going to see situations where, because they weren't fixing the dams and the dikes and the canals, that vast destruction occurred. So, for instance, your book talks about one of the worst events in human history in terms of natural disasters. In 1877, the Yellow River would flood. All of the dams and levees had not been maintained in about 100 years. So when this massive flood came downstream, all of the channels to hold the water were overwhelmed. An area the size of 50,000 square miles would be flooded. That is about all of the central United States, from Michigan down to Louisiana, going to about Kansas and Kentucky. It was estimated that in the flood, over 2 million people would be driven off their homes. And when the pandemic broke out, because all of the fields were destroyed, about 1 million people would die. Starvation. So, what does this mean? Well, just like everything I said before, the peasants suffer. Food shortages, being manipulated by the landlords, crime, everything went out of control. And of course, it wasn't that long that people in China started saying the mandate was lost. But, unlike what happened before, as we're going to see, nobody would rise up and try to establish a new dynasty. We'll see that in the end. But, things were awful. You had more mouths to feed, you had more urban expansion, you had more crime, more violence, everything. And in the end, 4,000 years of Chinese history would come to an end in the 20th century. But no spoilers. We'll deal with that for the things. All right, so I don't know what the weather's going to throw us on Thursday. There is snow or messy grossness in the forecast. Obviously, if the college cancels class, you already know what I'm going to do. I will do another video. And I haven't checked the analytics yet. But if, like I said on that last one, if 95% of the class watches the video all the way through, and I can tell, unique users, how long you watched it, I will add extra credit into everyone's averages. But just look for an email from me or an announcement from Engage, and I'll keep you up to date. And obviously, if the college doesn't cancel classes, I'll see you on Thursday. Yes, sir.